Hi, I'm Rochelle Jackson. Welcome to the Crime Couch. I'm an investigative journalist and true crime author, and I know who's who in the zoo, the crims, the cops, and the interesting individuals in between. So get comfy and join me each week on the Crime Couch for a rollicking, intriguing tale. It'll be one heck of a journey. Ken Ashworth retired from Victoria Police last year as a detective inspector. He's had a highly successful career, been awarded an APM and two Chief Commissioner's commendations. Ken began in the job in uniform before becoming a detective and doing the usual stints in the CIB. He joined the armed robbery and homicide squads before working in the water police search and rescue squads. Ken was awarded a Churchill scholarship to study port security and CT, then was rotated back to the crime department where he worked in several squads before joining the Piranha Task Force. Ken then worked in the Trident Task Force where he investigated organised crime on the waterfront. I'm sitting with Ken today on the Crime Couch on a sunny but wintry day in Melbourne's southeast. Hi, Ken. Thanks very much for sitting with me on the Crime Couch today.
Pleasure, Rochelle.
Tell me, Ken, why did you become a cop?
Well, I guess it all started growing up in the 70s when we were watching things on TV such as Homicide and Matlock Police, and we're all interested and keen on that, and someone mentioned to me about Police Cadet Scheme. So basically I thought, I'll give that a crack. So I walked out of school one year and into cadets the next, and here I am now.
Was there much of a transition from school to being a police cadet?
Yeah, a lot more regimental and discipline-wise in the cadets as opposed to a bit of a larrikin at high school that I was. So it was probably good for me. In fact, it was good for me.
You spent more than four decades working as a detective. What makes a good detective?
Persistence, I'd say, and the inquiring mind, and an empathy for your victims, because you do it for your victims, and you want to see rights upheld and do good for people, yeah.
And it sounds like you'd need a very strong sense of justice?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, on all fronts. To achieve for your victims here.
You dealt with many crooks and villains, including one of Australia's most wanted, Christopher Dean Binns. How did you meet this crim, whose nickname is Badness?
Well, he used to ring me before I actually first met him. I think it was about 1991. I'd gone back to the armed robbery squad as a sergeant and in charge of a crew. And Binns had been charged by another crew and was out on bail but had absconded. And we received a job one, I think it was a Friday afternoon, that the State Bank in Williamstown had been held up. So we went out there to start the investigation into it, and a chap on my crew said, gee, this MO looks very much like Chris Binns's. He used to, two cars were stolen, and the way they were manipulated was very similar. And then we looked at the security footage and the way he conducted himself in the bank. We were pretty happy that that was probably who it was. So speaking to my bosses, we were tasked with the job of continuing that investigation and trying to track Binns down as well. And so we basically worked full-time on him and that job. And other hold-ups occurred, which we were attributing to him as well while he was on the run. So this was about 6 months of work going on, I think, and then as much as we were inquiring about him and speaking to his ex-girlfriends and his family and that, he was doing the same thing about me. And he rang me one day in the office, joking, he's very cocky, and we had a conversation. I said, Chris, you're better off coming in and start. He says, no, I'm not going to do that. You do what you got to do, I'll do what I got to do. And it was just before Christmas. He sent me a Christmas card, and it has a Santa with a big sack on his back full of dollars. So he had a bit of a sense of humour. And he kept ringing me. He said, I'm only going to talk for about 2 minutes because I know you can trace the phone. And he said, I haven't done this and I haven't done that. And I said, well, how about we communicate in the classifieds, you know, if you're paranoid about bits and pieces. And he said, no worries, I'll put something in the Herald Sun tomorrow. So he wrote a thing in there, ashes to ashes, badness to badness, you know, I've been back, hasta la vista, baby, or something like that. So, and all this time we're working on him and tracking him down. And we realised, we reinvestigated several hold-ups because he was involved with a fellow called Miles. I can't think of his first name now, who's now deceased. Kevin Miles it was. And he was out on bail as well for a hold-up. And we just absolutely never left him alone. It was on the way to work, we'd call in and see him. On the way home, we'd call in and see him. And we'd meet him all over the place. And he said, no, no, I don't know where he is. But in the end, we actually turned him. We got him to roll. So he was going to give evidence against Binns. And I suppose it was about 8 months or more into the investigation. A hold-up occurs at the State Bank in Noble Park, which was the same bank that he was on bail for when he absconded. And it was done exactly the same way. It was, so straight away we knew it was Binns. So we sent a crew out to the airport because at this stage we knew he was living up in Bundaberg, up on the coast. So we figured he'd probably go straight out to the airport and head up there. Bingo. He did. That's exactly what he did. And so we got him out there. And I met him, I think it was in on the freeway. I went out as well behind the other crew, pulled over in Bell Street. I stuck my head in the back of the car. I said, g'day, Chris. And he goes, you'd be Mr. Ashworth. And I said, spot on. I said, we're going to talk back at the office, okay? And he goes, okay. And that was it. So I followed him back into the office, went upstairs to the Armed Robbery Squad office, and he was obviously searched and all that sort of thing, the usual protocols. Sat there in the interview room with him. He said, when's the bashing going to start? And I said, I'm not going to bash you. I don't need to bash you. No one's going to bash you here. I said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you a number of questions about a number of armed hold-ups, and you were going to be charged with a number of armed hold-ups. And he's a bit surprised with it. I said, no problem. Can I do anything for you before we formally start the interview? No, no, no. So we had a bit of a chat, and he says, I've never met a copper like you. I said, well, you know, I'm just an investigator. I've just investigated a whole lot of things. And then I reeled off the banks that we'd redone, and we'd found new witnesses and bits and pieces, followed it up. So he knew that I was fair dinkum, and he knew he was in a fair bit of strife. So we just had a bit of a banter of a conversation, and I said, gee, your mum's a lovely person and that, and, you know, call around there. And she gave me that big bag of cash that you left there. He was his eyes rolled up, and I said, we'd sit down. She'd make a cup of coffee for me. We'd have a chat, you know. And he knew that I was all over him, knew what he was doing. Mm. I said, we're aware of Bundaberg and back and forwards, and it's just a matter of time and stuff like that. Anyway, this was a covert tape that I was running as well, which, for a number of reasons, you run covert tape. Anyway, formally he was interviewed. He didn't say anything. And then he was charged with a number of hold-ups and subsequently remanded. So he's comfortably on remand at Pentridge, I think. Yeah, it was Pentridge. And then we get a call one afternoon that he's been stabbed. He may not live. They're taking him to St. Augustine's, which is a security ward at St. Vincent's. Oh, that's interesting. So we just monitor his condition, and he was getting better by the day. And he got a visit from his father, who's also deceased these days. He went by the name of Pocotic. And later, as it turns out, in behind his belt buckle, he had a small revolver, which he smuggled into St. Augustine's, gave it to Chris. And when Chris was about to be returned to Pentridge, he produces the gun and he escapes from St. Augustine's, runs out of the building. And the car was made available for him around the corner, so he knew what to go and where to go, which was later recovered in Carlton at a hotel, a motel there in the car park. And then he was on the run again. So we continue our inquiries, etc., etc., and we think, no, he's going to go. He'll be back interstate somewhere. It's too hot here in Victoria.
So all the hold-up squads around the country were all aware of him, you know, likely to be and things like that. And back in the day, we had a very good relationship with the Sydney hold-up squad. We were always back and forwards on extraditions and things like that. So next thing, they start getting a few hold-ups up there out of the norm and almost identical to here. And one in particular, I think it was Parramatta, and he got cornered in the bank and he shot his way out the back, blew the glass windows out, just blew them away. He wasn't adverse to letting shots go during hold-ups. He shot at a young kid at High Point. It was, I think it was Target. There was a, he did a hold-up there on a bank, and he got cornered there by this kid, and he said, back off, and the kid didn't, and he let a shot go, and it went through his shirt. He's very lucky, that young fella. These hold-ups go off in Sydney, and eventually he gets caught by the hold-up squad up there. So we go up and see him. I think it was me and Glenn Davies fly up and see him. And he was caught with his then-girlfriend, Lorna Skellington. So we spoke to them in the cells, and, you know, it was a bit, comical. We didn't interview him for anything like that. We said, you know, once your matters are dealt with up here, you're going to come back to Melbourne. You realise that? He just said, yeah, whatever. So we just made small talk again, and that was fine. I think that was the first time I'd met Lorna. Anyway, he is remanded in Sydney, and he's at, I think it's Parramatta Jail. It was Parramatta Jail. And they're moving him one Saturday morning. And the next thing, he breaks away, and it was described as, it was like a scene out of a Batman movie. He makes this Batman leap onto the wall and gets over. And he's gone again. Incredible. So, again, he's on the run up in Sydney. And, of course, all of Australia is looking out for him, waiting for the hold-ups to occur. Because as he said to me, I said one day, what do you do with all this money? You know, we did a calculation, and it was a million plus. And he says, it's expensive on the run, Ashy. Okay. Yeah, he said, I've got to feed Lorna, and, you know, we stay in good places, and, I eat crayfish, and, fair enough. So he says it's an expensive business. So anyway, a hold-up occurs up in Sydney, and it's an armed guard truck is ambushed at Darling Harbour, and a guard is shot dead in that. Well, the next day, and we all think, oh, hang on, what's going on here? This is the same as the Sydney boat crew. And anyway, there was two offenders, and one resembled the sort of build and the way Bins did things. And he rings me the next day, and he says, I didn't shoot that guard. I didn't do that job. I said, well, I don't know about that. You know, why don't you just come in? Because you will eventually be caught. And he goes, can't do it, and hung up. Then he's still on the run, and he surfaces back in Victoria. And he's at a farm at Creswick with Jockey Smith. And I think it was a Saturday afternoon. Anyway, that's the day that Jockey Smith gets in a stolen car, goes into the town of Creswick. He's detected by a member who only died just recently, Ian Dizzy Harris. And Jockey pulls a gun, and there's a scuffle and bits and pieces, and a shot shots. Ian Dizzy Harris shoots Jockey dead. Well, at this stage, the farm's under surveillance as well. So the SOG go in and grab Bins there. And he's taken back into custody. Jockey's dead. I go and visit him on the Monday or the Tuesday, I think it was, in hospital. He was in hospital because of the injuries and a bit of a scuffle that happened with the SOG. And I have a bit of a laugh. And he said, I didn't think first visitor would be you. So I have a bit of a laugh, and I said, oh, well, you know, it is what it is, but I'm still working on you. And he goes, yeah, no. I said, okay, I've got to get up to Bundaberg, but, you know, I'll be in touch with you. So anyway, he's languishing there, and then he gets remanded, and he goes into the high-risk area down at Barwon. We go up to Bundaberg, and we work with the Bundaberg detectives, and we find his property up there, and we seize a whole lot of stuff. At this stage, he's passed the girlfriend, Lorna, we're turned, she's rolled. Mm. And she said, look, I don't know if they did the hold up, but they did. They did go up to a cave and they did hide all this camouflage clothing, which is what they were in the hold up. Mm. We find it up there. Mm. But there just wasn't enough to take it any further. So come back. I'm trying to think how it happened. Oh, that's right. He ends up pleading in the end down here, and he gets a good deal because he was giving evidence against some coppers. So he gets a sentence here and then does his time here, and then he gets whisked away back to New South Wales. Mm. And he fights the charges up there. So I get called up there to give evidence. And I thought, what evidence can I give? But it was all about the evidence of the investigation, conversations and MO and things like that. Mm. And I'm standing in the witness box in front of the jury giving the evidence, and there's Chris on the other side in the dock, and he's looking at me and winking and laughing and carrying on. And in the end, he thought it was a great joke. And he subsequently gets convicted up there and does his time up there. And then resurfaces down here. He rings me at that stage. I think I'd been promoted to inspector at the water police and search and rescue squads. And he rings me there. And he says, what are you doing? I said, poor the point, what are you doing? He said, oh, I'm out now. Do you want to catch up for a beer? And I said, oh, yeah, but it'll want to be a very open and public place with cameras, Chris, for obvious reasons. He said, yeah, no worries, I'll get back to you. Next thing, I don't hear from him. And during his time in custody, he was writing letters to me as well. Mm. All sorts of funny letters. I've actually got him over here. Anyway, next thing he surfaces on the footy show, Sam Newman sticks his head there and has a...
What, his street talk?
Street talk, yeah. And off he goes. And the next thing I hear, he's doing some extortions and stuff at a nightclub in the city, and he gets arrested for that. And he goes again, and the letters start going again. And then he gets out again, and that's, I can't remember the year. Anyway, it's irrespective. He gets out, and he is confronted by police at a pizza place in Nidri, and he's on a stolen bike, and they confront him, and he produces a gun, and they know who it is, and off we go again. He's wanted again. Mm. And then he does an armor guard truck. It's about $200,000 by himself. He doesn't buy himself. He's brilliant. As a hold up, oh, very gutsy. Mm. Yeah, a lot of dash. So he takes the revolvers off the guards, I was sitting here at home, and I near dropped my glass of red wine when I saw it on the news. I said, that's beans. So I rang the hold ups, and they said, yeah, we know it is. We're working on him. Mm. Anyway, he gets confronted, they're tracking down to a house in Keilor, I think it was, and the siege starts. It goes for about 44 hours, and he's on ice, which confused me because he was always dead set against drugs. Mm. So go figure the rationale of all this. Oh, I can't work it out. But anyway, the siege goes on, and he's eventually shot by the SOG with the bean bags, and he's taken into custody, and he's looked at straight away by a doctor who was there. And he's got a heart rate of about 80, something like that. Just incredible. So it's just off his head. So he's taken into custody again, and the letters start coming back to me again, bits and pieces. Mm. And he wrote me a letter, and this is an old crook trick. He said, oh, I'll confess to all the crimes now. I did this one where a security guard was shot at Brunswick. Mm-hmm. I wrote back to him. I said, impossible. I charged the fella for that. It was a bloke called Sando Mercury who we convicted him. It's all over. I'm aware of the trick of trying to veer to self-charged so you throw out all the other charges and bits and pieces. Don't bother, Chris. He writes back, yeah, I had to give it a go. And then the letters just keep coming, and he writes to me where I was. I think it was at Piranha, actually. And he says, I've converted to Islam. I now want to confess to all those crimes you spoke to me about to cleanse my soul. Mm. I said, okay, I'll come down. I said, I'll bring two detectives from the armed crime squad down, and they can do the follow-up investigation and brief and things like that. Mm. So we go down there and down into the security area of the high-risk place, and they bring him out. He's all shackled and he's smiling and he's pumped up. and they uncuff him and everything like that, comes up and gives me a hug. And I say, okay, Chris, let's just back off. You know, so I shake hands and he says, oh, it's good to see you. Yeah. And I look across and the two fellas from the armed crime squad are looking at each other thinking, what have we got in here? So we sit down and, you know, how's it going in here and bits and pieces? And he says, oh, yeah, you know, it's not too bad. See, he's been institutionalised his whole life, ever since he was a child. You know, he was bashed by his father and he doesn't know any better. Anyway, we sit there, we're just making small talk and having a chat and what's the food like and bits and pieces. And he said, oh, I survived an attack from that Johnson fella. He shows me a huge scar. He said, I was lucky I didn't bleed out. I said, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, again, the small talk, bits and pieces. I said, look, I've got an appointment this afternoon, so can we get down to business? He said, yeah, no worries. I said, well, the high point job where the shot went off, he said, yeah, I did that, da-da-da-da. So he confessed to all those jobs, and I made sure that he said things that only the offender would know. So I knew it was him, and I said that to the guys here. At one stage during that banter, he leans forward and he talks to looks over to the blokes, and he says, you know, back in the day when Ashy and I were working together, and I interjected, I said, hey, these up. We never worked together, you know. I wore the white hat, you wore the black hat, you know. Good guy, bad guy, that's how it goes. And he goes, yeah, you know what I mean. I said, you'll have these blokes thinking I'm the Roger Rogerson of Victoria. Anyway, they're still looking a bit worried. I said, come on, let's talk about these hold-ups. And away we went, and he went through them. And I made sure, as I said, he mentioned things that only the offender would know. So that was it, and the guys were happy. Did a formal interview with him and away it went. Yeah.
So, Ken, how did he get his nickname? How did he get his name, Christopher Binns, you know, Badness. AKA Badness?
Self-appointed, gave it to himself. He had an XD Ford registered Badness. So he had a tattoo on his girlfriend, Badness. He was just bad and he was happy with it. Yeah.
And obviously the ego goes along with that as well, as you were saying. How does he rate? How does he compare with the crims you've worked with in the robbers? You know, you've obviously got I wouldn't say a respect for him, but you certainly know his MO.
Oh, yeah, we have a rapport. There's no doubt about that. And you should try and establish a rapport with an offender. You know, get over this, you know, good guy, bad guy, I really hate you because you're a crook and the crook really hates you because you're a copper, you know. And he got it. In the end, he got it. He said, I was doing what I was doing. You were doing what you were doing. You know, I've had pretty good rapport with most crooks over the years, and I've always found you get better results. When I was a uniformed senior sergeant at Paran, we had the cells and the court operating. And I'd often walk past the cells and someone would yell out, Mr. Ashworth, and you'd go and talk to crooks you've locked up, you know, for all sorts of offences. But they respect you for what you do and how you treated them.
How important is it to have that rapport so that you're kind of like, it's almost like in the Disney character where you've got, you know, that Shetland dog and you've got the coyote and they both, you know, go, g'day Fred, g'day Ralph, you know. How much is it like that, you know, where you both know where each other stands and you're not, you know, like there's no love lost, but you know what each other's up, you know. Like as you said, there were times when you were investigating him and he knew that.
Yeah. Look, you've got to be on your guard, but you try and get that rapport because they will let things slip. And you're always looking to cultivate informers as well. Now, a lot of people think, oh, they're crooks, but informers are always crooks. They know the crimes. That's the circle and the world in which they live. So if you can turn some good crooks to give you good information, that's how you solve a lot of crimes.
And how does he compare with some of the other crooks you've worked on?
He's unique, absolutely unique. I've never had a rapport quite like I have with him, the way he writes letters and sends Christmas cards and things like that. I've had him in tears. We're talking about Jockey Smith and his mate Kevin Miles, and he said, you know, anybody close to me always seems to die, and he's crying, and you know, said, "Oh, that's all right. You know, candies and tissues, and can I get you something?" Things like that. But he is as cunning as ever. Yeah, you wouldn't turn your back. He would. He'd do anything to get out again.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So you got to have that healthy respect, you know, and keep your guard up. Because as much as you can have a good rapport, you've always got to maintain that guard.
And you've always got to know where you stop and start. Is that also, like, that's where some detectives run into difficulties, don't they? Like, what stops you and how do you know where that line is?
Judgment call, I suppose, at the time. You've got to remain professional. You've got to remain isolated to a certain degree and just be very careful and take guidance from other members as well and your senior officers. When you're meeting with a crook, meeting with an informer, say you're doing this, it's all recorded and things like that. So to protect yourself, you've got to be very careful.
And it's always placed in your diary.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Diary and day book.
So what do you reckon created Christopher Binns?
Don't know. He told me, which is, this is quite ironic. The first time I worked at the Armed Robbery Squad as a detective, the first hold-up I went to was a Keilor TAB, and that was his first hold-up. So the irony of it, I guess, you know, we're entwined from that day on. So he told me years later, and we both laughed over that, but, you know, that was his first hold-up. That was the first one I went to at the squad. So there you go. But, look, he was stealing bikes as a kid. He was just born bad, I think. Yeah.
Didn't he grow up in Tirana as well, like the boys' home?
Yeah. Institutionalised from a young age, roaming the streets of Braybrook. Always getting into trouble there, always taking on the coppers and losing most of the time. Yeah. It's funny, last time I spoke to him, he said, I have PTSD. I go, oh, it's interesting. He goes, well, you think back, every time, you know, some of the dealings I had with the coppers, I always thought I was going to get shot or I was going to get bashed or whatever like that. I thought, well, that's an interesting take on it. Not quite, you know, the norm, but he's an interesting character.
Mm.
Yeah.
And it sounds like he's smart enough to exploit every loophole you could possibly give him.
Absolutely. Absolutely he would. Yep. Mm. Yep.
Why do you think he trusted you?
Because I treated him fairly, equally. I didn't threaten his family or him. Yeah. And we just ended up having that rapport.
At one stage, wasn't Binsey planning to kill Julian Knight at one stage when he was in jail? Is that right?
Yeah. Look, I've heard those rumours. I don't know the ins and outs of it. But he was rumoured to be doing that. And he was an escape was foiled too between him and another crook I'd charged, Santo Mercury. They were trying to tunnel out and they were caught. So, he's always on the move if he can to get out. Mm. Yeah, somewhere, yeah.
And the tragedy is he spent most of his life in jail and, like, is that sort of a person ever capable of being rehabilitated?
Not that I've seen. And I've dealt with many crooks that have been professional armed robbers and they just never stop. Mm. They might move into drug dealing and some other things, but long-term crooks are long-term crooks in my experience.
When was the last time you saw Binsey Ken?
2017, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Down at Bowen. Yeah. He doesn't know. I don't think he knows I've retired. And I certainly haven't given him his address to write to me. But I know he's in for a long, long stretch. He didn't know when he was going to get out.
I love the fact that he sent you these Christmas cards and he sent you letters. And I believe at one stage he even was rumoured to have booked a motel room using your name. Now, is that accurate?
That's you have done your research. Yes, that's right. Yeah, use my name. Yeah.
Did he get away with that?
Well, he probably paid in cash.
So, okay, he's been given an extensive jail sentence for a number of serious armed robberies, I think 18 years, 2 months on the top and a minimum of 14 years, 2 months on the bottom. I think he won the right to appeal. He wasn't successful. How much is the legal system just another thing for him to try on?
Oh, absolutely it is. Absolutely. Well, that's probably the only avenue he's got, I suspect, because... because of his history of escaping and everything, he's got to be one of the highest risk prisoners in the system at the moment. Yeah.
So where is he? He's in Barwon, and does he move in with the Overcoat gang, or do you know what gang he's with? Is he in his own gang?
No, I don't know. Well, they had their prisoners of war people there, the Johnson runs, and who killed Carl Williams, and those battles are always going on, and I suspect it was over that why he got stabbed by Johnson. But when I last time I saw him, he had the little Islamic hat, I don't know the term of it, on, and he just said wanted to keep to himself. The last letter I got from him, he was starting to write children's books. I thought, oh, you've got the chopper syndrome. But as I said, he's probably aware that I've retired, but no one's forwarding the mail.
Thank goodness. Now, how is life for you now, Ken? How do you turn off from all these fun and games?
I actually don't miss the job because it changed so much over the years, but just glad to be out of it. You know, I've got family I spend a lot of time with, a number of sons and grandsons and a granddaughter, and I like gardening. Doing things like that. I like a ride on the bike. Most mornings, if I don't ride, I walk. That takes me through to lunchtime, and every day is a bit of a Sunday. So it's good.
Well deserved.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, Ken, thank you very much for sitting with me today on the Crime Couch.
Pleasure, Rochelle. Pleasure.
Thanks for joining me. I'm Rochelle Jackson, and I look forward to your company next time on the Crime Couch.